Good evening, everybody. I'm Carla Sharp, and one of the moderators for our GAP call-in series. We are very pleased tonight to introduce to you Dr. Efrain Blyberg. I have had the pleasure of knowing Efrain now for about 15 years since we both moved to Houston in the early 2000s. Dr. Blyberg was born and raised in Monterrey in Mexico, where he grew up and attended medical school at the University of Nuevo León and the School of Psychology of the University of Monterrey. He came to the United States in 1977 to pursue a residency training in psychiatry and child psychiatry at the Menninger School of Psychiatry and Mental Health Sciences and psychoanalytic training at the Topeka Institute for Psychoanalysis. He joined the staff at Menninger in 1981 and moved to Houston with a clinic in 2003 to take a faculty position at Baylor College of Medicine and at the Houston Center for Psychoanalytic Studies. At the moment, Dr. Blyberg is in private practice in child, adolescent, adult, and family psychiatry, psychotherapy, and psychoanalysis. He's also a clinical professor of psychiatry and child psychiatry at the Menninger Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Baylor College of Medicine, and training and supervising psychoanalysts for the Houston Center for Psychoanalytic Studies, CFPS of Houston here in Texas. Dr. Blyberg has been a thought leader and a co-developer of mentalization-based therapy with Peter Fonagy, Anthony Bacon, and a bunch of other mentalizing folks. He was also one of the first people to really spearhead early identification and prevention of borderline personality disorder and other personality pathology in young people. And I think, Efrain, your book that you wrote came out, what year was that?
2001.
2001, because it was the very first book I actually read on developmental aspects of BPD and adolescence, and certainly changed my trajectory. So it's a huge pleasure for me to introduce you. I'm going to hand over to you in a moment. I'll just remind our listeners that you can follow along on the slides that Dr. Blyberg submitted and we've made available on the NEA BPD website. Dr. Blyberg will indicate as he goes along where he's at in the slides. He'll talk for a little bit. And then I will ask him some questions if we have time. With that, I'll hand over to Efrain. And just a big thank you for giving freely of your time tonight, Efrain. And we are really eager to hear you talk.
Well, thank you very much. And really thank you for the opportunity to participate in this podcast. I was actually thinking about what I was going to say this evening, and that I was then reminded of the rather humbling research that basically indicates that the average adult listening to the averagely boring lecture, or I guess I apply equally to the averagely boring podcast, I'm referring to mine, not to the other ones that have preceded me, hears about half of what he said, then understands about half of what he hears, then believes about half of what he understands, and finally remembers about half of what he believes. So I did a rapid calculation that I have about 2.5 good minutes to be audible, understandable, believable, let alone memorable. But I do take some solace from thinking that I will be devoting a good chunk of my good 2.5 minutes to these remarkable processes, these remarkable capacities that are mentalizing and epistemic trust. And I'll say a little more about this in a moment. As they come to life in the context of this other remarkable human capacity, which is attachment. So I want to propose that these capacities of mentalizing and epistemic trust is really what underlies how we humans hear one another and understand one another. That's mentalizing to be able to understand one another, and the corresponding capacity to feel understood, which I'm going to be submitting, is the key that opens the possibility of believing in others, of trusting. That is, to be able to put our guard down, particularly in the moments when we need it the most and we can do it the least, which is when we feel threatened, when we feel stressed, when we most need to learn something new. And to be able in that particular context to keep our guard down, to keep our defensiveness down, and allow not only for the other person to get close to us physically and emotionally, but also for the information, the knowledge that that person communicates, to get in, to be internalized, to be learned. That's the epistemic part of epistemic trust. To learn and to remember and to be able to then apply that information, particularly the social learning that we do about the social world, the emotional relations with others that we utilize to construct and reconstruct our sense of ourselves and to renegotiate our social relationships, our map of the social world. So I hope that with this little introduction, I kind of piqued your curiosity and get you interested in knowing more about what is mentalizing and what is epistemic trust and why it matters. So just to emphasize, as slide number 3 indicates, this means pay attention to this. Mentalizing refers, therefore, to the skills and the attitudes, what we do and how we do it, when we attempt to understand the intentions, both of other people as well as of ourselves. Now, we do that by trying to grasp and to imagine, to interpret what's in the mind of ourselves and of the other person. What are the thoughts, the feelings, the needs, the wishes, the fantasies that make our actions and the actions of other people meaningful and intentional, that they have a direction, however odd they may seem, however maladaptive they may appear, however painful may be. Like, why would a person be, for example, cutting himself or herself? Now, to explain what it is that we do, how do we do it when we mentalize, is actually very challenging. And it's challenging because when we unpack, when we start unpacking mentalizing, we appreciate that it's not a simple process. It actually has several components. It has one component, one way of processing that is very fast, is automatic. It's intuitive. It's visceral. It has to do with grasping the empathically the other person's feelings, and that's very hard to explain. How do we do this very automatic, very fast process? But this way of processing then is balanced by a second way of processing that is slower, is more controlled, is more cognitive. This is really mentalizing proper. which has to do with interpreting, with thinking, with taking a step back and looking at different perspectives. And we find out that it's really is the balance between these two ways of processing. And that's where mentalizing really lies, is in the balance. Now, of course, explaining how to do it is hard. So what we do really in treatment, which is the very same thing that that parents do in normal development, in normal parenting, and it's the very same thing that that teachers do in education, is to model it. That is to demonstrate, look what I'm doing, look the attitude that I take, look at the actions that I engage in, when that result in you feeling that I got you, that I understood your perspective, that I understand your point of view. Now, this is then followed in treatment by coaching. We want to highlight to the person when they're doing it right. Yes, you look what you just did. You know, you really got it. You really understood why your father did such and such thing. You really were able to kind of put yourself in the shoes of your mom and see how is it that she ended up responding to you the way she did. As well as to interrupt when they're not doing it right. So we model and we coach as a way of communicating what mentalizing and the skills and attitudes of mentalizing consist of. Now, I said earlier, why does this matter? Well, it matters because it may well be that mentalizing and epistemic trust are really an important part of what I'm going to propose to you, maybe the most important question in mental health, which is the question of resilience. As it is suggested by a very important research project, one carried out by Jay Belsky and a true constellation of some very heavyweights in the study of the development of psychopathology, like Terry Moffett and Avshalom Kaspi and Peter Fonagy, etc., who followed 1,100 families with twins in the United Kingdom. There were 2,200 twins, and they follow them prospectively. They follow them going forward in their development, and study that their development, their environment, and then at age 12, assessed how many of these 2,200 children met criteria for the more extreme levels of the dimensional features of borderline personality. Those features like affective dysregulation and impulse lack of control leading to harm that occur very specifically in the context of emotionally intense relationships. So they find out that of this population of children, 3% meet that extreme level of dimensional criteria, which first challenges this view that that you only can be borderline at age 18. As Carla was pointing out, I've been really interested in the development leading to the emergence of borderline personality earlier in life. That is that pointed out that children don't wake up after their 18th birthday to discover that the previous night all of a sudden they became borderline. Now, when they studied how many of these children who had Of this entire population of 2,200, those who have experienced significant adversity and trauma in their development, for them, the chances of being borderline at age 12 were not 3%. They were significantly, although not dramatically higher, they were 7%. Subsequently, then they checked those in that population who had a genetic vulnerability, not specifically to borderline personality, but had first-degree relatives with major psychiatric disorders, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, borderline personality, major depression, etc. And they found out that in this group or this subgroup, the chances of being borderline at age 12 were not 3%, they were also significantly, but again, not dramatically greater. They were 8%, more than twice. But then those who had both, adversity and the genetic vulnerability, for them, the chances were 40%, which is dramatically greater, highly significant. But here I want to suggest, you know, that perhaps the more important question than how is it that genetics and adversity come together to create the conditions that generate this borderline symptomatology at age 12, that may be even more important might be the question of what protects the other 60%, those 60% who, in spite of genetic vulnerability and early adversity look like any other 12-year-old, look like ordinary kids. And that is the question of resilience. And in this study, there was a very nice correlation between the robustness of what they call theory of mind, which is another way of referring to mentalizing, and the protection along with a number of other capacities that seem to be generated also in the interaction between genes and environment that pave the way that pave the path to resilience. That is, for this capacity to function and adapt effectively in the face of adversity or vulnerability. What produces that protective umbrella that Antonovsky calls salutogenesis, what generates health in development. So I want to spend a couple of minutes now talking about attachment as the context in which this salutogenic protective factors like mentalizing and epistemic trust appear to be generated. So attachment is really one of the marvels of human evolution. We are genetically prepared. We come encoded in our brain is already the capacity to recognize the certain signals are threats to our survival. That signals that come from inside of our body or from the world around us, such as a drop in the levels of sugar in our bloodstream, or sounds that signal the possible presence of a predator. We don't need to learn that hunger is bad for us or that the presence of a saber-toothed tiger is not good for our survival. And those signals automatically, with no need for reflection, decision-making, just automatically trigger a stress-defensive reaction of fight, flight, freeze. That automatic set of psychological, physiological responses that prepare our organism to escape, to fight, to protect ourselves. Now, in fairness, if you have watched a baby trying to fight or to flee, it's pretty pitiful response. It really wouldn't do very much to help that infant survive the presence of a saber-toothed tiger. That stress response, that defensive response, only became effective and adaptive when it evolved to trigger attachment, that is, to trigger this pattern of physiology, of movement, of vocalization, that served as a signal that other people, other humans, were disposed to mentalize, were disposed to interpret, were disposed to say, "Oh, honey, you are so hungry." See, the interpreting of the signal, and then respond in a way that eliminated the threat to survival and calmed down that very aroused baby and very aroused brain. So given this connection, see, between being able to activate attachment and signal to others, and the necessity of others to accurately read and interpret our signals of distress, it is no wonder, you see, that infancy researchers have documented that normal babies come very powerfully disposed, not only to recognize, and I'm not talking about a cognitive reflective recognition, but a very visceral recognition of the connection of the match between their signal and the effect that that signal has on other people, between the affect that is carried out by their signal and the affect of other people who respond to their signal. So this is what Peter Fonagy described as psychic equivalence, that is, this notion that what I feel, the other person feels. What other people feel, I feel, which can be kind of cute, as demonstrated by my then 2.5-year-old son, Daniel, when I ask him, what does mommy want for her birthday? And without blinking an eye, said, "Mommy wants a cement truck." Well, my wife didn't really want a cement truck, but he wanted a cement truck. Therefore, she wanted a cement truck. So I'm only trying to illustrate how strongly we're really generated to put ourselves in other people's shoes and to get other people in our shoes. And that we generate this empathy, this by creating a kind of a visceral simulation in our brain of the kind of brain activity that other people that we observe are having when they are feeling something or they are doing something. And this kind of simulation is probably mediated by a very special kind of neurons, a neuron system that we call mirror neuron system. Now, crucially, it looks like the heart of what we call secure attachment is based on infants' visceral sense of effectiveness in ensuring their survival by their capacity to evoke responses in others and the confident expectation that others will respond to their signals. Now, the other side of that coin is that the very essence of trauma, given that what we have encoded in our brain is that our survival depends on other people getting our signals and mentalizing them, interpreting them accurately and responding in a timely and effective manner, that the essence of trauma is really that we send a signal and nothing happens, is that we are ignored, that we are socially helpless. It's social helplessness, really, that when I'm facing distress and I'm alone, and I cannot evoke a response in others that will help me. So lack of reciprocity, that social helplessness, is really also encoded as the fundamental threat to survival, which automatically activates a defensive response of fight, freeze, or flight, of anxiety, of distance, of dissociation, of anger. that is intended to reverse that state of helplessness. Now, even if this is meant to be a defensive reaction, this protective response actually is not very adaptive, particularly when we have to deal with other people. And I want to really emphasize this, as it's so pertinent to what happens with people with borderline personality, where they feel threatened, and that threat evokes a strong defensive protective response. However, we have growing evidence that one person's defensiveness is interpreted by the brain of other people as a threat to them and evokes an automatic defensive response. When somebody approaches me anxious, angry, distracted, and ignoring me, all of those defensive responses evoke automatically a defensive response in me, which in turn is going to make the first person feel more threatened and get more defensive, which in turn makes me more threatened and even more defensive. The really pretty tragic vicious cycle in which borderline people and their loved ones often find themselves trapped. And a vicious cycle that is particularly pernicious, because once you have that defensive reaction activated, once you have that defensive wall in front of you, first of all, you really can't see very much. You bounce against that wall in front of you. You are not really, that's the notion of psychic equivalence, that you only see what's already in your mind. Basically, we end up being able to only see our own anxiety, our own anger, our own shame, our own distress. We cannot see the other person very much. But also, and perhaps more crucially, nothing gets in. At that moment when we need more than ever to be able to learn a new perspective, we're really not able to get any new information. Now, fortunately, it looks like evolution really worked out a way that attachment could provide a mechanism to shift from this very automatic, very inflexible way of responding to have it balanced by a more controlled, more flexible, more kind of context-dependent, perspective-dependent way of processing. That is mentalizing. Now, there is good evidence, and I will only cite people like Ruth Feldman, who have studied babies and their mothers prospectively from birth onward and can really document what are the components of what is an effective response of the caregiver, what is an effective attachment response. Now, the kind of response that actually is going to generate mentalizing and epistemic trust. Now, very importantly, I don't want to suggest that adequate, that effective response means that caretakers get their baby right all the time. Actually, what research suggests is that when carefully observing interactions between babies and their caretakers, that the good enough caretaker is also a bad enough caretaker. By that I mean that the good enough, the effective caretaker gets their baby right about one time out of every three, out of every three signals that the baby produces, the caretaker accurately and in a timely fashion gets one. But what happens in between is very important. That is, the caretaker doesn't get anxious, doesn't get defensive. It persists in an attitude of curiosity, of interest, in an attitude of respect, in an attitude of trying to really check and find out until he or she gets it. And once it gets a disrepair, see, because we're constantly experiencing these mini traumas, these mini failures of understanding. But repairing them appears to be really the signal that activates two very crucial developments in the infant. The first one is that it appears to be an important component, this attachment context in which babies get understood, not perfectly, but one time of every three. And I want to mention here that this is good for average babies. There are some babies who are super sensitive. There are some babies who pick up the failures and react to them with much greater intensity. John Gunderson spoke about what he called hyperbolic temperament. And there are some suggestions that this may be one of the risk factors, one of those factors that goes with that genetic predisposition, this super sensitivity to not being understood, this super sensitivity and high intensity of reaction, particularly with an intensely negative mood to when we get frustrated because we are not understood. So that's to signify that what works for everybody may not be quite enough for children with a particularly intense sensitivity. But for average children, this good enough parenting, this getting it right one time of every three and repairing the failures that happen inevitably, seems to really be an important factor in evoking the evolution, the coming online of parts of the brain that are important to, number one, put the brakes on the automatic emotional response that comes from the limbic system and the posterior parts of the brain, just this top-down regulation. And secondly, that allow for the control of our attention in a way that makes possible for babies, and we can document this by the time babies are about 9 months old, they are able to appreciate that what they see is not what is, that what they see is only their perspective, because other people may look at things from a different perspective and may be seeing something different. This ability to appreciate that there is more than one perspective is perhaps the beginning of a new, different, more flexible, more perspective-dependent way of processing, which is what includes mentalizing. That includes forming categories, making stories, using symbols, being able to play and look at things from more than one point of view. And it starts a process by which we begin to mentalize. We begin to represent all these aspects of our experience that initially we process only in this automatic visceral way. Now, of course, we are always going to be left with some aspects of experience, some elements of our experience. They are like buckets that are never mentalized, were never mentalized, and remain like vulnerable spots that when they get activated, when they get touched, they evoke an intense defensive reaction, and they evoke the turning off of mentalizing and the very defensiveness that I described earlier. It so appears that for borderline people, that vulnerable bucket may be the very experience of being in attachment, the very experience of getting distressed and having, under conditions of distress, activated our necessity to get another person to respond to us. This is called attachment disorganization, which seems to be the activator of a defensive response in borderline people. Now, in normal development, the antidote to this automatic defensiveness when our vulnerable spots get touched is a second major acquisition of attachment, which is epistemic trust. It also looks like to be understood seems to be the signal that it is possible, particularly when we feel stressed, when we feel threatened, not to go in a defensive mode, but to keep our guard down and to pay attention and learn from the person that gets us right, who understands us. With the message, and this seems to be an important adaptation in evolution, because we really need to learn a lot of social, cultural information in a very short period of time during the first few years of life, and we needed to have a mechanism to tell us, from whom am I going to learn? What is right, what is wrong, what is sacred, what is profane, how to use tools, what language do I pay attention to, etc., etc. And that signal seemed to be that signal of epistemic trust, which I want to suggest, and this is certainly one of the premises of that group of mentalizers that Carla was referring to, that we very much believe that this may very well be the key ingredient of all effective psychological interventions. That the key ingredient may be that what we do really in all forms of therapy is to engage with a person and then look at the situations when they feel threatened. And in that context, say, now stop. Don't do what you normally do when you feel threatened, which is that you activate your defensiveness and drive yourself and other people who love you berserk. Instead, hold on, stay, keep your mind open. Open to learn new possibilities, new skills, new ways of looking at yourself, at the world, at other people, at your relationships. Take this, what I refer to as the therapeutic bargain that therapy always offers, which is the replacement, the taking the risk of trading the ways that you know to protect yourself, the ways that you have relied for your survival, to have some sense of control, some illusion of relationships, and instead take the risk of trying to achieve genuine mastery, real attachments. So I'm going to end by summarizing what I think the study of mentalizing and epistemic trust teaches us about what are the elements of effective intervention, I think, with patients generally, but I think particularly relevant for people with borderline personality. Number one, that is very important to interrupt those vicious cycles in which defensiveness, loss of mentalizing, loss of epistemic trust in one person breeds and reinforces defensiveness, loss of mentalizing, loss of epistemic trust in the second person, which then reinforce all those same situations in the first person. Those vicious cycles, the importance of interrupting them. Secondly, that is important to model and to promote in oneself as well as in the patient and as well as in those who are part of that person's relationships, in that attachment system of that person's family, an attitude, a way of approaching, of respect, of curiosity, of non-defensiveness that may allow people, that is of mentalizing, that may allow people to understand one another and to feel understood. Because this understanding and feeling understood is then the key, particularly when we learn and to practice how to repair the inevitable breakdowns that are going to happen in all relationships and to which borderline people are particularly sensitive. Learning how to repair is what is going to breed that trust that is going to make possible to learn something new, to have the courage to change when feeling threatened. Thank you very much.
Well,
And
Efrain, thank you so much. I always, marvel at the fact that every time I listen to you, I learn something new. Thank you so much for a very elegant explanation of the developmental model for BPD and also the rationale for mentalization-based therapy. I wonder if a good place to start. I have some questions about the developmental aspects that I think we can return to, but I wonder if we could start where you ended, which is these goals of MBT. And I'm wondering, we may have people from all kinds of orientations listening tonight. Especially from a more skills-based therapy orientation, but I'm also asking as a parent, it seems really important to mentalize in psychotherapy. It seems really important to mentalize as a parent. How does one go about then interrupting those vicious coercive cycles? How does one model and promote mentalizing? How does one take a stance of curiosity? How does one make someone feel understood and listened to, and so forth? Can you give us a little bit of insight into a sort of session, perhaps? It could be
Yes.
with a teen or with an adult, in how that process works in the
Yes.
MBT context.
Yes. Right. Before I go into how to, you mentioned that there are clearly people with a number of different therapeutic orientations, and certainly a number of therapeutic orientations that have good evidence of effectiveness. So I'm not here to suggest that the only model that is effective, of course, is the mentalizing model of personality. But I do believe that that regardless of what your particular orientation happened to be, all effective therapists actually generate epistemic trust. That all effective therapists recognize, however they articulate this explicitly or they know this implicitly, that the other person, your patient, is not going to learn anything unless first he feels understood by you. That the very first aspect of is to really listen to that person and generate the sense that I understand you, that the person gets that sense that you got me. You may not agree with me, but you got me. You understand how things feel like from the inside. And only from that position of feeling understood, people then activate that possibility of trusting that makes learning something from you possible. Now, the question of how do you do it? Well, I think these are all the components of treatment that include everything from education, because it's more possible to help people recognize what happens to them when they lose the ability to hear, when they become defensive, at times when they are not feeling like that. And the explicit education, helping people recognize how do they feel when they get defensive, how do they feel when they feel threatened, and what happens to their ability to appreciate, and what they can do at that moment to take that, to push that button that slows things down for them and allows them not to lose their ability to hear, and to communicate, and likewise to feel understood, as they also can learn to appreciate the impact that they have in other people when they get defensive. The very careful effort to stay with the patient where the patient is, that is to first begin always by recognizing and validating the patient's experience. that before you do anything else, before you challenge, before you expand, before you confront, before you suggest the possibility that maybe we can try something different, the foundation has to be, let me hear you and let me appreciate and understand what you are. That first step, and we talk quite a bit with parents of adolescents about how significant it is to change the conversation from one that is, how do I get my son or my daughter to behave, to how do we make sense of one another? How do we slow things down enough that we can begin to make sense of one another instead of escalating each other with increasingly more coercive interventions? So it's just a bit of a sampler of what is really sort of outlining the entire treatment model that goes into what is really the crucial aspect. How do you generate trust? As the title of the conversation, of this discussion was, this is really the heart of the matter. How do you learn to trust so you can trust to learn?
Thank you. And I imagine with people with BPD, that is a significant barrier because the core of the disorder is really that loss of trust.
Exactly.
So I'm wondering, how in your experience is it different? Because we know that we can do MBT with any kind of disorder. When you work with someone with BPD or personality pathology, in comparison with someone with a different type of pathology, how do you find the MBT to be different?
I think that the first issue is that the difference, I don't know that they are categorical, they may be more dimensional. When in effect, the issue of trust and mistrust, I think, is a variable that you're going to find throughout. I do very much believe that this is the sort of the holy grail of what makes psychotherapy effective. And you're absolutely right that the particular cruel dilemma of people with borderline personality is that the very moment, the very tool for them to get help, which is the creation of a relationship, is the very thing that is so threatening to them. And that is the very thing that makes the treatment lengthy and difficult and exposed to crisis. And those crises, by the way, apropos of how does this happen, well, what I find repeatedly is that we have the opportunity to have multiple breakdowns. And I always tell my patients that, you know, it's one of the few things that I am certain, because I'm not certain of many things, but I'm certain that I'm going to screw up and I'm not going to understand them and I'm not going to get things right. And I know that those things hurt. But at the same time, after that has happened, and particularly when I can acknowledge my responsibility in hurting them because I didn't understand them, because I got anxious, because I got upset, because I got angry, and I didn't get them. And I know that that hurts. When I can do that, I model one crucial capacity, which is the capacity to repair. I think that part of what makes the breakdowns in relationships so catastrophic for people with borderline personality is that they don't know how to repair. So if there is a breakdown, it feels like everything is lost. The relationship is lost. Their life is lost. There is no possibility of repairing. When they learn to repair, and I start by taking it upon me to model how do you repair, which, by the way, has two components that I also try to teach people. One, the first one is that you need to take responsibility for what you did that hurt the other person. So you don't take responsibility for the fact that they feel badly. You take responsibility because you were stupid. You were insensitive. You were angry. You did something that was hurtful to the other person. And the second one is that you take responsibility for not responding defensively when the other person continues to be defensive. So once you practice this in relationships, it begins to shift and do what I think happens normally in development, which is that that experience of repair is really a crucial component of how trust gets generated. So I actually welcome the opportunities and the fact that in normal development, as in therapy, we therapists are very fortunate when we get it right one time out of every three.
Wonderful. So that is perhaps a good segue into some of the developmental questions that came up for me. Certainly, the mentalization-based theory of BPD and personality pathology is attachment-based. And a lot of our examples when we talk about mentalizing stance in the context of caregiver-child relationships, a lot of those examples come out of the sort of mother-infant or caregiver-infant context. I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about how mentalizing between a caregiver and a child may look like as a child gets a little bit older. We generally think about the mom and the contingent mirroring and motherese and all of those things when the baby's an infant. But a lot of personality pathology begin to emerge, of course, in adolescence. What do those healthy mentalizing relationships look like in typical adolescence, so that we know what we're shooting for, right, as a parent?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because you're absolutely right. I mean, we put the emphasis on early development when mentalizing is first acquired. And we got to remember that that's the beginning of a developmental process, that mentalizing is going to continue to evolve, that mentalizing at age four is quite different than what it was at age one, that at age four, children now get to be able to really integrate those two modes of processing. You know, that they are able to really look at other people's perspective in a way that they couldn't when my son Daniel was thinking that his mom really wanted a cement truck for her birthday. And to be able to follow and appreciate how they are able to mentalize. That becomes particularly important in adolescence. Adolescence is a time when mentalizing really is going to go through a major revolution, and you know we don't really have time to do justice to this very complicated process. But the essence of it is that controlled part of mentalizing, which is mentalizing proper, that is the one that kind of can put the brakes on the more automatic, more visceral, more emotional aspects of empathy. That goes through a whole process of reorganization. It's in many ways, there is a process of pruning. There is a process where certain networks involving control mentalizing are going to be selected and going to be is during adolescence really where we more specifically are going to acquire the patterns to mentalize as more autonomous and more independent humans with our own way of figuring out, among other things, the right distance, the right distance that allows us to be ourselves but still to stay connected. And it's very hard for adolescents to mentalize properly during this turmoil. which is one of the reasons probably that they are really not capable of utilizing this protective function and are thus more vulnerable, particularly those who come to adolescence with a history already, with a legacy of impaired capacities, particularly impaired or weakened mentalizing to begin with, that makes them much more vulnerable to be the time when borderline personality may emerge. And that's a particular challenge for parents generally, is how to stay connected and understand this contradiction, these sets of difficulties, and at the same time to tolerate the need for more space and more distance of the adolescent. So to really mentalize this very complicated state in which adolescents find themselves is complicated, but at the same time, because their own mentalizing is going through this revolution, they very much need both to be given distance, but also they need a scaffolding of mentalizing around them in the preserved capacity to mentalize of the parents. So it's that may be a whole other conversation that I think, you know, if you want to take it with your planning committee for the, you know, the mentalizing issues in adolescence and the relevance that has to the vulnerability to the emergence of borderline personality.
Oh, thank you, Irfan. And we've got a few minutes left, and I wonder if we can just spend a little bit of time on this issue, something I've been thinking about a lot as a person who was originally CBT trained and became more moved over to sort of a mentalization-based approach gradually. I think there is still a lot of fear or discomfort about learning this psychodynamically-based intervention and how one goes about it if you don't have a sort of psychoanalytic training background. Can you talk a little bit about that? I'm not sure how many people are online with this. Mentalizing is extremely simple and yet very complicated a thing to do. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts? Perhaps we can end with that. Just thoughts on training novice therapists. I also put novice therapists and parents in the same category, but I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your thoughts over the years and how they've shifted in how we can have a whole new generation of therapists benefit from what I perceive to be an absolutely key ingredient of all psychotherapies, like you said earlier.
Yeah, I actually find that the less experience and training you have before you want to learn how to mentalize, the easier it is to do it. Because, you know, the key to mentalize really is to be able to take the attitude of openness, of being prepared to be surprised, of really being open to see what's in the other person's mind without the assumption that I really know what is going on with that person in a way that the other person doesn't know it. And I think that actually, you know, there are certainly many wonderful aspects of a psychoanalytic tradition that really facilitate your ability to be sensitive to others. But there are some aspects, I think, that actually work the other way around, because they put a heavy emphasis on a theory built around understanding unconscious process and the notion that you know what's really going on because you have this elaborate theoretical model of how the mind is working and how the mind develops. And I think that it actually, more often than not, gets in the way of being able to take a genuinely mentalizing stance, which is, as I said, one that almost requires you that humility and that courage of tolerating not knowing, of not using your theories to actually close the gap between what you really know and what your anxiety requires you to feel that you know.
That's a nice way of putting it. Well, Efrain, it has just been a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you on behalf of the listeners and also our organizing committee for a very stimulating and informative. I've always thought if there's a person I'd like to be in therapy with, it would be you. So thank you so much.
Be careful with what you wish.
Thank you, Efrain, and thank you to everybody who called in, and we'll be back next week. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.